Right now on Last Call, holy Micron, the memory maker, turning it up a notch, and the market loves it. Dive into this. Reddit is pricing its big IPO, but will you take the plunge? A state known for oil looks to go big into natural gas, and its governor will join us exclusively. A stunner out of Elon Musk's Neuralink. Wait until you see this first human patient video. It'll blow your mind, and it might make you tear up. Plus, Paramount's Hollywood moment, a big bid coming in for the studio, but will the media giant bite? And it is high-end booze you can use. Americans have been shrugging off champagne, but not anymore. And one of the world's most famous families has a plan to turn things around. We might even get a little taste ourselves. All that and more over the hour. So belly up or buckle up with some high-end bubbly. Last Call is up right now. Well, good evening here, good afternoon out west. I am Brian Sullivan, and we are back in New Jersey. All that and more coming up in the hour, but first up on Last Call, the words sending stocks to uncharted territory.
We believe that our policy rate is likely at its peak for this tightening cycle, and that if the economy evolves broadly as expected, it will likely be appropriate to begin dialing back policy restraint at some point this year.
Now, Fed Chair Jay Powell admitting that inflation is still too high, but he also said this.
There's reason to think that there could be seasonal effects there. But nonetheless, we don't want to be completely dismissive of it.
And Wall Street loved that. So we hit a hat trick. The Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ all closing at record highs. First time, by the way, that has happened, that all three hit a record on the same day since November of 2021. Dare we call that, guys, random but interesting? I think so. It was also a great day for the small caps. The Russell 2000 had a nice 2% pop, its best day in more than a month. We've talked about this broadening out, small caps finally taking the plunge. And guess what? They have been. All right. So as you hopefully keep making money, has the Fed signaled it is full steam ahead for the record rally? And there is more to come. Let's talk about it with our friend and a guy who's been right for years. That is Tom Lee. He is the managing partner and head of research at Fundstrat. Tom, you just keep being right. I mean, how much longer can this market keep going up?
Hi, Brian. I think there's still quite a lot of gas in the tank. If you think about the dry powder, there's $6 trillion of cash on the sidelines and margin debt still below where it was a year ago in July and almost 20% below where it was in October 2021. I think the economic momentum's really picking up now that the Fed is essentially confirmed it's dovish. I think that's a good signal for CEOs. And there's so much skepticism out there. When I do meetings with my partner, John Bay, we find investors are either angry bears or ready to exit stocks. I think people aren't comfortable with equities, and I think it's it's something that shows you sentiment's negative.
Angry bears, I love that. I mean, are there still any bears out there? Do you have any clients, anybody you're talking to that is decidedly negative, or have they just literally just given up?
You'd be surprised how many bears remain staunch bears because they're earning 5% on cash, or they don't like the fact that they view this market as driven by seven stocks, which is really factually not correct, or they view the market as expensive because, excluding FANG, it's at 16 times, but someone says, well, yields are at 4, almost 5%. I think there's a lot of reasons people can be bearish.
If you had to be bearish, then, let's play a game. I mean, if Tom Lee, we know you've been bullish, you've been right. If you had to be bearish, what would be the one argument that Tom Lee's evil cousin would make?
If I called my evil cousin, I would say the concern would be that commercial real estate spirals into a larger debt crisis because liquidity is something you can't fix with stock prices rising. So, that was a big concern in 08, and it was a concern in 02, 03, and of course that was a concern in 2020. That hasn't happened yet. It looks pretty contained, but that's something we are watching, is that, the bond market really does run on confidence, and it could turn, but so far it's been good.
Yeah, I was reading a story yesterday about collateralized loan obligations, CLOs, in the commercial real estate market. I'm thinking, really, is this, what year is this? Although hopefully that market is a bit smaller. But that's also, by the way, why we do watch commercial real estate, Tom. You know, again, we talked about the Russell 2000. Big day today. Small caps appear to be all in. Are you all in on small caps?
We are. I mean, our view is that small caps are, on a relative value basis, back to where they were in 99, which was a launch point in 99 for a 12-year outperformance period. I think that means with the Fed doing a dovish pause and CEOs getting more confident, and that means M&A and IPOs and people looking at other sectors, I do think the Russell can rise 50% this year. So the Russell 2000 basically getting to the Russell, you know, to 3,000 as a price level.
Wait, what?
You say the Russell 2000 is roughly...
I want to be clear. 50%?
Yes.
Not 1.5. I couldn't tell. It was a 15, 50. I just want to make sure the audience know. 50% this year, Tom?
That's right. And the reason is that the companies that earn money in the Russell are trading at around 11 times earnings. I mean, so there's a huge PE story along with a price-to-book story. There's a lot of Russell 2000 stocks that are actually trading near cash as well. So, I mean, there is a lot of reasons why larger companies might acquire some of these smaller names. And, of course, there's a big biotech weight in the Russell 2000, which, again, is gaining momentum. And, of course, when the Fed starts to cut, the regional banks benefit. And, you know, there's a huge financial weight in the Russell. So I think the Russell 2000 represents sort of the best of things that happen when the Fed starts cutting.
Well, as the great Forrest Gump said, I'm not a smart man, but I have a feeling that we will see a headline on CNBC.com tomorrow about what Tom Lee is saying about small caps. That's a big number. A lot of people out there hoping you continue to be right. Tom Lee, we appreciate you joining us to kick off the show. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Wow, 50%. That's a bold call on small caps. In the meantime, let's take a look at what happened inside the markets today. The big winner of the day, yeah, Paramount. Climbing on a mega offer, but only for its movie studio. Top Gun Maverick 2, maybe, stock up 12%. Big decliner, I'm going to say big, it was the biggest decliner. NASDAQ down a mere 2.5% because most stocks rose today. All right, a lot more to do on deck. Reddit's big moment arrives. The breaking developments around its debt and reaction from top tech analyst Dan Ives coming up. Plus, numbers just out on America's debt and deficits. And folks, if you're not sitting down, sit down. Trust us, because these debt numbers, they're grim. All right, let's get now to tomorrow's news tonight. And tonight, we're talking IPOs. One, maybe two in particular. Reddit announcing its IPO price at $34 a share a short time ago. Is that good or bad? Who knows? Well, Leslie Picker knows. She's going to join us now with everything you need to know ahead of its trading debut tomorrow. Leslie.
Hey, Brian. Yeah, I don't know what that means for tomorrow's trading debut because I don't yet have a crystal ball, but that price tag was at the high end of the range Reddit had been marketing to investors for the last week and a half. It implies a fully diluted valuation of $6.4 billion. That's a discount to where Reddit last raised funds privately at $10 billion. That valuation from 2021. Its road to go public began shortly after that. It's been 827 days since Reddit announced it had confidentially submitted its paperwork to go public, and it appears that long-awaited day is nearly here. In the prospectus, Reddit calls itself a, quote, global digital city where 73.1 million daily active users collaborate through different communities with common interests. The headlines, just while the company was on its roadshow, again, week and a half here, encompassed a letter from Nokia alleging infringement of some of its patents and an inquiry by the FTC into Reddit's agreements to share content with third parties to train AI models. Some investors were also surprised that Reddit, despite being a two-decade-old company, was not yet profitable, and that the pursuit of profitability had upset users, leading to a user blackout in the middle of last year. But others look at this, they see S&P at record highs, that it's a company that has very good top-line growth of 21%, and a scarcity of new issuance as a reason to buy in. So we'll see what happens when Reddit makes its debut tomorrow, Brian, but certainly bodes pretty well pricing at the high end of the range for this new issue market that's been notoriously pretty dormant for a while now.
You know, because you're a relatively new parent, and nobody would say that 10 is old, except if you're a stock, right? I mean, that's kind of the knock on Reddit, is it? Is that this company, which, by the way, just, you know, it's very cool and all the boards and everything, it's been around a long time, which, ironically, some people are kind of knocking.
Yeah, it's 19 years old, so it could be going to college.
Can almost drink?
It can almost drink. It can go to certain bars in certain college towns. We'll put it that way. Hmm. But... yeah, in terms of monetization, though, it's still more nascent. It's only been selling ads on its site and truly monetizing that top line for about 10 years. So I think a lot of investors look at the lack of profitability for a 19-year-old company and they say, well, you know, that's a pretty long time, but they've only been truly seeking to monetize for about 10 years of those 19 years or 9 years of those 19 years. And so I guess in that trajectory, they say they've got a total addressable market in the ad space. They've got a total addressable market that they can reach by 2027. And, you know, at least with this Google partnership that they have in the AI space, they also say in their roadshow video that there's a total addressable market for them in commerce, selling of goods and services on their platform. So we'll see how that transpires into top line growth over time. But in terms of advertising, which currently represents about 98% of their revenue, that, you know, it's about 10 years old for that.
We'll see it. 19, they can drink at McGill. Leslie Picker, thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, for more on Reddit and the IPO market, maybe more, because we can just ask him whatever we want, it's Wedbush Securities Managing Director Dan Ives. Dan, we've all used Reddit, but from an investment perspective, what is it?
Look, I think it's really about engagement. I mean, if you look at their daily active, you know, users, 70 million plus, the question is, it's advertising. I mean, this is a company that's going to do $1 billion revenues, you know, into the next year. So as well as they talked about, can they start to take that advertising? And then when you think about all the data, can that ultimately be an AI story from an LLM? And I think that's, if you look at this from an investor perspective, what's the appetite for Reddit? This is a potential watershed moment, broader for tech, to just show the appetite that we're seeing in Astera Labs and others.
So let's talk about the AI, because it's interesting. And of course, I was at an energy conference this week and everybody was talking about AI. AI learns in part by scraping everything, all this stuff. Reddit, I'm guessing over 19 years of billions and billions of posts, has a lot of stuff. But I do wonder if it's accurate stuff.
Sure.
Right? Because you can. There's some crazy stuff on Reddit.
No doubt. But I think, to your point, maybe 5 years ago, even a few years ago, the data, the value of that was not what it is today. So what this has really done, I mean, AI has really put even more like a Reddit or some other names on the map because of the data and because of how you could actually monetize that. And I think that's what we're seeing in this market. This AI revolution, it's not just on the enterprise, it's not just about Godfather of AI, Jensen, NVIDIA. You're starting to see it spread. And I think that's why this is such an important week, showing the appetite is there in the markets.
The CEO, Steve Huffman, who was a UVA Cavalier, but I won't hold that against him, made, I think, $193 million last year. Does that, I mean, good for him, I guess. Does that bother you from just any kind of an investment perspective or corporate governance perspective?
Look, it's going to be an execution story. I think for a lot of these, you know, when you talk about some of those comps, now it's can these companies execute and can investors get paid? Because when you talk about the IPO and you talk about everything that's happening here and some of the worries about froth in the market, can you execute and ultimately make investors money as a public company? And that's what it comes
down to. Can they? That will answer your own question. What do you think?
Look, and I think the jury's still out for any of these companies as they turn public. Can they be successful and can they monetize? I think you cannot argue with the success that Reddit's had. Now it's just not just talk to talk, walk to walk, execute on the numbers.
Yeah, if it's just a free site that has some ads on it, I mean, that's going to be a very different story than if they could start selling goods, if they become like an Amazon-ish thing.
Well, that's the focus. It's like, where in the social media tiering structure can they be?
Dan Ives, Wedbush Securities, as always, Reddit. Listen, tomorrow, it's going to be a big day. Just kind of, what's the appetite, right?
It's all about ripple effect and what this shows in the market.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to bring that up, by the way, because it's all about appetite. See how much investor demand is there for companies. 19. It's like dog years. Yeah. You know, I might be 158 years old, you know? Exactly. Dan, thank you. All right.
Thank you.
By the way, the gentleman we just mentioned, the Reddit CEO, Steve Huffman, he will be on Squawk on the Street. That's about 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, first on CNBC. Obviously, a lot to discuss there. Lansing, Michigan's own, apparently. All right, still ahead. When you think of Alaska, you probably think natural beauty, grizzlies, and oil. But now the state wants to be known for something else. Alaska's governor joins us live next. Plus, the astounding, unbelievable video just out from Elon Musk's Neuralink and its first human patient. We're going to show you some real-life mind control. It might make you tear up, honestly. We did, and it's next. All right, welcome back. A state known for its size, its beauty, its oil, is now looking to get into the natural gas game. We're talking, of course, about Alaska. It is hoping to build out a big new liquefied natural gas terminal to its energy mix. The project would bring gas down for the North Slope, there's the map, and then ship it out below Anchorage. Now, that design hopes to make it easier to get the much-needed gas to Asia without having to go through the Panama Canal, just kind of a quick hop down the Pacific. So let's talk about that and some of the new EPA rules that could rock the auto world. Joining us from CERAWeek, where we just were, is Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy. And Governor Dunleavy, thanks for joining us. I happened to actually run into some of your guys last night that are out there trying to help raise capital for this project, for this big LNG project. How realistic, Governor, do you think that is?
Well, you know, we have the gas. We have trillions of cubic feet of gas. We have the location. We're only 8 sailing days from Tokyo in uncontested waters. We have the ability to store carbon. This is another aspect of this pipeline project that most people don't think about. We can store upwards of 50 gigatons of carbon in Cook Inlet and another 150 gigatons of carbon up in the North Slope. That's 200,000 gigatons of carbon. That is probably more than what the world produces in 4 years. And so tremendous amount of opportunity for not just gas for our allies, gas for in-state use, but also to deal with carbon as well. And so we've got a lot of folks looking at the project. It's certainly the largest project, I think, in the world at $43 billion, an 800-mile pipeline, liquefaction plant, CO2 conditioning plant. So it is a major, major project. And so folks are looking at it, but obviously they want to make sure that this is going to pencil out. We think it will, and hopefully over the next couple of months, we'll have some folks that really want to get into this.
You are the only state that I have not spent the night in or been to. I got 49 down. I got one to go. So I have to trust the video about the natural beauty that we are seeing, Governor. And you hit on that carbon storage. Explain exactly, though, what kind of you mean by that. Because, again, you've got, I'm told, one of the most beautiful states out there. You want to keep it that way, but also produce the gas. How do you do that in a secure, sort of more climate-friendly-ish way?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So we don't flare our gas in Alaska as a matter of daily operations. We reinject our gas in the North Slope back into that basin. And so a couple things. We don't have to explore for new gas. We know exactly where the gas is. We're reinjecting it every day. We know how much we have. And as a result of that reinjection, you don't get methane or carbon in the air. So once we build a pipeline 800 miles down to Nikiski by Anchorage, as you mentioned, There's a basin there called Cook Inlet. That was our first oil and gas exploration area that produced a lot of oil and a lot of gas for Alaska. It's right next to our largest sea, Anchorage. That basin, those caverns, are now getting ready to be able to receive carbon. So we have a pickled LNG plant. Most people don't realize that it was Alaska that actually pioneered LNG expansion for the United States. In some cases, some people say it was the first in the world in 1968. With our Japanese allies, and that produced gas for almost 50 years with our allies. So we know how to ship gas, we know how to develop gas, we know how to set this up. And so Alaska does it better than anyone in terms of taking care of our environment. We are very careful, and I would challenge anyone anywhere in the world to have their standards match our standards. And so putting the carbon into the basin reduces carbon worldwide. I think it's approximately an estimate of the 44 million cars this pipeline would offset in terms of carbon as we sequester that carbon as well. So a lot of opportunity here to produce clean energy for Alaska and for our Pacific allies.
Well, I kind of like it. I admire the fact just it's very Alaskan that you're trying to do it on your own. It's not being developed by a private company. You guys, the state of Alaska, and its couple partners are trying to do it. I want to switch gears, literally, Governor, if you don't mind. The Biden administration and the EPA announcing new strict rules for the auto industry. They want to limit tailpipe emission averages within 8 years so much that effectively a majority of cars and trucks sold will either have to be all electric or hybrid. If they don't, they won't meet the goal. So basically, this is going to kind of push people to hybrids or EVs even further. Investors didn't care. The stocks all rose. And Governor, while we all want to do our part to combat climate change, all that from another tailpipe, when I'm picturing Alaska and I'm picturing the distances and I'm picturing the cold weather, is this rule gonna work for many Alaskans?
Well, I'm always suspicious of mandates and rules, especially at this scale. What you're certainly going to need is a lot more electricity. And, that's one of the things we've learned with this AI revolution going on. You're going to have to double, if not triple, your electrical output. And that includes, if there's more cars, you're probably going to need more electricity. So you're going to have to come up with base fuels, not just renewables, but base fuels. That's why we're interested in shipping our gas overseas to be able to produce that energy, that electricity. And so in a place like Alaska, you certainly have cold areas up by Fairbanks. It could get 50 below in the wintertime. That's challenging for the technology we have today for EVs. But along our coast, which is a lot warmer, and we have hydro along our coast, we have EVs now. And so we've done this through the market, the existing markets. We didn't force or mandate this on folks. So you'll see EVs in Alaska. You'll see pickup trucks in Alaska. You'll see hybrids in Alaska.
There you go. Mike Dunleavy, the governor of the great state of Alaska. I'm going to get up there one of these days. You just got to come. You got to move closer to the. I'm kidding, Mike. Governor, thank
We're
you.
We're only 3 hours from Seattle. Just hang a right when you get to Seattle.
That's it. 2 hours from Seattle. I love it. I'm going to hang a right at Seattle. I'll remember that when I do make it. Governor, thank you so much. Great stuff.
Absolutely.
All right, coming up. New video you have to see from Elon Musk's Neuralink and its first human patient. It's powerful stuff. Plus, a wild week for AI chip makers just turned. Even wilder. We'll tell you why we say it, and it's got nothing to do with NVIDIA. Oh, we got a bonus TNT for you, and this is powerful stuff, okay? We don't say that much. Elon Musk and Neuralink just posted video of the company's first ever human brain implant patient. The video shows 29-year-old quadriplegic Noland Arbaugh controlling a computer with his mind. Neuralink successfully implanted Noland's brain with a chip back in January. At the time, Neuralink said he'd be able to, quote, move a mouse around the screen just by thinking. A lot of people wrote that off. Well, guess what? Show it again, folks. I mean, that's exactly what just happened. And here's what Noland Arbaugh had to say.
It's crazy. It really is. It's so cool. I'm so freaking lucky to be a part of this and stuff. I mean, I just, every day it seems like we're learning new stuff, and I just can't even describe how cool it is to be able to do this.
So I just want to be clear what just happened. Noland Arbaugh had a Neuralink chip installed in his brain, and he just moved a mouse on the screen playing chess, not with his eyes, not with any kind of a hand controller, literally with his mind moving the mouse. He was injured 8 years ago in a freak diving accident, and now this may have changed his life for the better. I know Elon Musk can be a polarizing guy. He's got huge numbers of people that work for him also that have nothing to do with Elon Musk. They're just smart scientists doing what they do every day. And to change that guy's life like that and maybe many more, it's remarkable stuff. The future, everything is not terrible, folks. It is, in many ways, an amazing time to be alive. All right. Meantime, it's been all artificial intelligence and chip stocks all the time here on CNBC. I know. But it's for good reason. Just look at shares of Micron right now. The stock is soaring. After hours, up 16%, almost $16 a share. Micron makes, memory storage, DRAM chips, things like that. And they say they're seeing a boost to business because of what else? AI. Then there's Intel. Intel was just awarded $8.5 billion in funding from the CHIPS Act. The grant will help expand domestic semiconductor production and create a total of 30,000 new jobs. Shares of Intel popping on the news this morning, but then kind of fell throughout the day. They ended very fractionally in the green. Here is Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger in an interview with John Fort earlier today.
It's an exciting day for Intel. We would hope to be manufacturing the most advanced AI chips for all of them, for Intel's products, but for AMD and NVIDIA and Apple and Amazon and Google. We want all of those chips to be manufactured in America, taking advantage of the R&D that's done here uniquely in America as well.
All right, so a lot of news there and AI and related issues. Where's the best opportunity for you, the investor, and could there be a risk of AI fatigue? Let's bring in Satori Fund founder and portfolio manager Dan Niles on this. It's all the rage, Dan. It's amazing. We just showed Neuralink. It's not really AI, but you get the point. I mean, there's some amazing things that are happening. I was just at an energy conference where pretty much everybody was wondering, this is awesome. Do we have the electricity to do it?
Yeah, I mean, as you said in your prior segment, it's a great time to be alive because you have so many interesting things, whether it's a person being able to control a computer with their mind or drug discovery, lots of things that should help the human condition driven by harnessing the power of artificial intelligence. So I think everything right now is getting painted with that brush, which, as we've seen in earnings so far, is not the case. A lot of companies that said they were AI beneficiaries, that's true, they're benefiting from AI, but the rest of their business was weaker, offsetting all that goodness. And then you have companies, obviously, like NVIDIA, which we still like, and it's the standard bearer for this. And that's the one that I think if people want to have an investment longer term and not ride out the short term moves that you're going to see, to your point of AI fatigue, that's the one that I would own because it's not actually that expensive. It's trading at less than 40 times earnings. There's actually a lot of semiconductor companies that are trading above where NVIDIA is trading because of the hope that they will benefit from AI, whereas NVIDIA actually is driving the AI revolution at 90% plus revenue growth this year. So that's where I would stay to participate in AI going forward and ride out any short-term fatigue, which I think it's quite likely when we get to the summer.
Listen, I love AI. I'm going to ask for a raise because you can't spell Brian or Sullivan without the letters AI. So that alone should just get me a raise. Dan, I want to turn to another story that's kind of catching our eye. Bloomberg reporting the Department of Justice could sue Apple as early as tomorrow. The DOJ alleging Apple is violating, it's all alleged, violating antitrust laws by blocking rival companies from accessing hardware and software features of the iPhone. Shares of Apple taking a little bit of a dip. Apple at one point, one of your biggest shorts, meaning you were betting Apple would fall. I'd like to kind of know where you still are on that. And what do you potentially make of this news?
Well, I mean, government, rightly or wrongly, and I think wrongly, thinks that if you're big, it's bad. And so the DOJ is already suing Google. The FTC suing Meta and Amazon. And so this isn't surprising. This will be the third time, I believe, in the last 14 years the DOJ has sued Apple. Now, if you want to get to the heart of it, is does Apple restrict access to their hardware and software on their iPhones? They do, but it's their iPhones. So we'll have to see how this plays out. But I think it gets into a bigger matter, which is they do put they take a 30% toll on their app stores, and that is the most profitable business for Apple. The services margins are in the 70% or so range, and the hardware margins are in the 30% range. And so if they have to cut their app store fees ranging up to 30% to something lower, this is 100% gross margin business. It's going to have an outsized impact on the EPS because of those margins, and even more so on the multiple, which is why people are willing to give this company, in my opinion, a multiple that's way too high, in the high 20s relative to the S&P that's trading at 22 times. And Apple hasn't grown revenues in 3 years. If you look at where they guided the March quarter to for revenues relative to where revenues were 3 years ago. So this is, in my mind, a slow moving problem that you're going to have throughout the year. But that's not even why I dislike the stock. It's obviously competition from China.
Well, we'll see what happens if indeed there is a lawsuit filed tomorrow and if anything happens from that. But for tonight, we say thank you, Dan Niles, Satori Fund. Dan, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Brian.
Speaking of chips, tomorrow night, be sure to catch the latest episode of CNBC Leaders. It's a big one. NVIDIA CEO, maybe the most famous CEO in the world right now, Jensen Huang, will be an hour-long special, CNBC Leaders, tomorrow, 8 p.m. All right, coming up, ESPN's fight to stay on top. We get a sneak peek at a must-see new CNBC documentary, and then we're going to taste a little champagne, Rothschild style. Stick around. All right, March Madness tips off tomorrow, which means time to fill out all your brackets. If you haven't done it, do it. Like many of you, including President Biden, I am ready to make my picks. Full disclosure, with so much travel lately, California, Houston, I woke up in Houston this morning. I have not had a lot of time to dig into the matchup, so this is more just like I like the team's jersey colors more than anything. And it's just for fun, but now I'll do it. You can humiliate me when I'm wrong. My final four picks, not real bold. UConn versus Arizona, Houston versus Kansas, not exactly taking a lot of underdogs. I get it. FanDuel has the odds of each making the Final Four. UConn, basically 1-1. Arizona, plus 230. Houston, plus 135. Kansas, the biggest long shot of the four, plus 1,500. If you combined all those odds, it comes out to plus 25,336, which means if you do a parlay on that as a Final Four, you bet 100 bucks, you can win more than 25 grand. Don't do that unless you're already rich. By the way, I think Arizona beats Connecticut. Sorry, Husky fans. And the Cougars eat the Jayhawks, and the team that wins the whole thing, the Houston Cougars. Their odds go all the way to plus 550. Now, like I said, I woke up in Houston, and I may know a guy whose name is on the court. But I think if the Cougars can stay healthy, this is Kelvin Sampson's year. It's his team. They got to stay healthy. I think the Cougars won it all. What do you think? All right, let's stick with sports and ESPN's fight to try to remain the worldwide leader in sports TV. It is the topic of a brand new CNBC documentary premiering tomorrow on CNBC.com/sports. It's called ESPN's Fight for Dominance. And it features interviews with current ESPN chairman Jimmy Pitaro, former ESPN president John Skipper, and former Disney CEO Bob Chapek in Chapek's first public interview since his 2022 firing. So let's bring in the guy behind the documentary. That is Mr. Alex Sherman. Alex.
Yeah, I'm excited about this, Brian. I've been working on this for about 3 months. I've went to Bristol, Connecticut, interviewed Jimmy Pitaro, head of programming Roz Durant. I went to an LSU South Carolina women's basketball game, followed around the ESPN crew there. I went to a Monday Night Football game.
Is that when the big fight broke out?
That was the second game, actually. This was the first one in LSU. Wild atmosphere, though. I mean, on par with
women's
any
basketball rules.
With any men's college game, like you just talked about.
Go
like,
Hokies.
Big women's basketball is eye-opening experience. I did not realize that it was quite at the level of big-time men's basketball like that in terms of atmosphere. Also went to a Monday Night Football game, hung out with Joe Buck and Troy Aikman. Learned about ESPN strategy even a little bit more than I already knew. And the documentary is really about how ESPN plans to compete in a digital world. They've been a behemoth in a cable world, and now they're moving with big tech competitors in streaming. We'll take a look right now at a clip from the documentary. This will air in full tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., but let's give a portion to the viewing audience right now. In the past few years, every major legacy media company has built its own streaming app. So has ESPN. ESPN Plus debuted in 2018 and gives users access to thousands of live games and studio shows for $10.99 per month. The app had 25.2 million subscribers. That's about half the number of Hulu customers and about one-tenth of Netflix's global subscribers. Still, ESPN Plus is really ESPN Lite. It doesn't include the network's most popular programming, like all of Monday Night Football. That's still exclusive to cable subscribers, at least until ESPN launches its two new streaming apps. Pitaro isn't yet sharing how much either service will cost. Both products are sure to be among the most expensive streaming services on the market. But it's not clear how many non-cable subscribers want to pay for sports at all.
My guess is there aren't more than 20 to 30 million homes that really are passionate about ESPN. And yet 100 million people at the peak were paying.
It's a dilemma former Disney CEO Bob Chapek thought a lot about during his nearly 3 years leading the company.
I think one way that you could look at it is to examine the percentage of people that really never tune into ESPN that are cable subscribers. that are paying for it and just assume that those consumers are off the table. And then you're going to probably have some light to medium users that may also depart because the much higher cost per month that they would necessarily be charged are probably going to exit as well. Well, I'll leave it up to the powers that be over at ESPN and Disney to figure out exactly what that price will be.
To increase the popularity of the flagship streaming app once it launches, ESPN has begun talking to potential strategic partners, including the NBA and the NFL, who could help market the product and provide it with additional content. ESPN could even offer a partner a small stake in its business, although Pataro says that may not be necessary.
It's not about equity, right? It's not about these partners taking an ownership interest in ESPN. This is about partnership and accelerating the launch or the adoption of ESPN flagship.
Looks awesome. So it's going to pop up on CNBC.com tomorrow in full, about 25 minutes long.
Yeah, it'll be on YouTube.
I'm a little
also
shocked. I mean, I met Jimmy and Burke Magnus a couple years ago. Great guys. It was not an interview for a job. I just ran into them. I'm a little surprised, though, they gave you that much access.
It was great. I mean, look, I think ESPN wants to tell their story to some degree because I think a lot of people feel like this is a declining business. And to some degree, I mean, they have right to worry, and you'll see that watching the documentary. But, excuse me, live sports ratings are up across the board. Monday Night Football is up. So they do have a positive story to tell.
Yeah. Let's talk quickly. A big story. Paramount. get this man some water.
Yeah, or champagne.
This man needs some champagne. If only we knew.
I've been working on this documentary for 3 months.
High-end champagne to help you swallow.
Exactly.
That's next segment. Very quickly, Paramount. Good news, bad news. Good news is somebody wants to buy it. Bad news is they don't want the whole thing.
Right. They only want the studio, an $11 billion offer from Apollo reported by the Wall Street Journal.
They want Tom Cruise. Maverick 3.
You love Tom Cruise. I mean,
Thomas Mapother from Glen Ridge, New Jersey. That's his actual name.
That's funny. It's a little awkward, like you say, because the rest of the company would, I guess, just continue to trade publicly, but you would take this big studio asset and sell it separately. So they'd get the cash from the asset, but the whole company would still be in limbo to some degree. So I don't know where that would
look at how nice Kareem is. Look at that.
Oh, thank you.
Got a water. Is it water?
It's water, unfortunately.
Sure?
I was hoping for the champagne.
Well, we're not going to drink the Baron de Rothschild in that cup.
Thanks.
That would be offensive.
I would still drink it.
So you think they're going to sell and just leave CBS News hanging in the wind?
I don't know. Look, I think maybe this is a good starting offer. And I think I reported on this show.
Offer. What are you, a realtor?
Well, look, I think Warner Brothers Discovery, which put pencils down, that had early talks with Paramount Global, now they see this, right? Mm-hmm. And it's possible that they could come back to the table and maybe work out a merger for the full company. That's what Paramount Global shareholders want, I think. They want a full takeover at a premium.
Yeah, why wouldn't they? Who wants that? Yeah, I'd like the good stuff. I'm not saying the other stuff is bad, but you get my point.
Yeah, this lets them fight another day if they went with this deal, but it is not a solving the major problem of this company.
All right, well, we'll talk more about that. Alex Sherman, can't wait. The documentary, ESPN's Fight for Dominance, premieres tomorrow on CNBC.com/sports, 6 a.m., coming up. We just referenced it like 8 times. How one of the world's top champagne makers plans to have more of you Americans saying, Santé. It is the most classy booze you can use we've ever done. And it's next.
Gender gaps in the venture capital industry are still massive. In the U.S., women comprise about 11% of investing partners. And last year, female founders secured just 2% of all venture capital dollars, while co-ed founding teams secured 21%. So over 3/4 of all VC dollars go to male-only founding teams. For Women's History Month, I'm Julia Boorstin.
Time now for one of our favorite segments, especially when you've been traveling all day. This is booze you can use, but tonight we're doing it a little bit differently because we're focusing on high-end champagne. Now, champagne overall, some of the sales lost a little bit of their fizz last year. According to a trade association representing more than 300 champagne houses, that's how they go by, total shipments of bubbly from France fell to 299 million bottles. That's an 8% drop compared to 2022. But a new brand with a very old and very recognized name plans to turn that around. Joining us on set is Frederic Marès. He is the head of champagne at Baron de Rothschild, makers of some of the finest wines in the world. Obviously, the name family's been around for a couple hundred years, and now building out champagne. Frederic, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian.
Why the Rothschild name on champagne? Why now?
So we can say, you know, first of all, that the Rothschild, since the beginning of the story, are champagne lovers. So they drink champagne since a long time. But in the same time, you know, in champagne, we have the chance to have a blend of, varieties, vintages, and villages. So it's maybe one of the world when you can have some blends to make, you know, the champagne. And for the family, they decided 20 years ago to go for the first time together, to make this project together. And they merged, you know, together from the three branches, mm-hmm. means, you know, Lafitte, Chateau Clark, and Mouton Rothschild, together for one third, to try to do the one of the best champagne on the market. And so we are there now.
Well, you just referenced three wines that I've heard of but can't afford. So, but this is actually a little more of an affordable luxury. This is not just for millionaires.
No. In fact, you know, we started since the beginning to make, you know, very premium champagne, you know, to be sure
Santé,
that you can get.
By the way, I can't let it sit here. Sure. I woke up in Texas.
And to get, you know, some very premium champagne from a reasonable price, you know, between, you know, $60-$65 on the shelf to $300-$400 on the shelf. You know, we have a full range with a very nice, you know, champagne from the Brut to the Prestige Cuvée Rare Collections. But all the Rothschild decided from the beginning to make, you know, this champagne to be sure that quality should be perfect and to get, you know, the premium range.
I think, well, this is fantastic.
Thank you.
Which one is this?
This one is a Brut Concordia. So it's
the entry level. So
yeah.
So this is $60-$65.
Yeah.
So it's not inexpensive, but this is not out of reach if you're looking for a special occasion, a high-end restaurant. Anything like this.
Yes.
And it's delicious, by the way.
Thank you. And for sure, you can have, you know, the best terroir inside. The best first growth and high growth, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir from the best terroir.
Yeah, I don't drink a lot of champagne, but I love it. I would imagine that with the de Rothschild name on anything, there's a lot of pressure to make it good.
Yes, in fact.
That's one of the most famous names in the world.
Yes.
I don't need to remind you.
In fact, you know, since now 14 years, I work for the family. And of course, your remark is very, very right, because, you know, when you see the still wine that they are looking to do in the world, but the champagne, the expectations are so high with the three branches, but we try to trust it and to reach it. And, you know, I think so we are on the targets now.
How have you found the U.S. consumer is booming? You live in France, but you've got a booming U.S. business. Great sales team, by the way. Great marketing people. I want to say that for Baron de Rothschild. But what's the reception been like? I mean, the U.S. consumer's booming, but I know some guys that own some restaurants. It's a crowded space.
Yeah. But, you know, in fact, you know, for us, you know, U.S. market is very strategic because, you know, we started to release the bottles in 13, and now after, you know, 10, 11 years, we are roughly at 15% of my turnover, you know, in U.S. And the potential is huge because in U.S., as you said, American people love champagne. You drink more champagne. Now it's the second market after France. And so we are also, you know, champagne lovers for a lot of bubbles, but a lot of premium champagne.
Well, there we go. Baron de Rothschild Champagne, Frederic Marès. Really, santé.
Santé. Cheers.
Merci beaucoup.
My pleasure.
Folks, merci beaucoup for watching Last Call in French. So I'm just going to thank you for watching Last Call. We'll see you tomorrow. Shark Tank is next.